What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Kropczyk. And John, in posting this episode, we acknowledge that this is Cybersecurity Month in America.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. We should have a celebration.
Yeah. Well, here's what you do to celebrate. Now, this is exciting. You back up all your files.
That's right.
You perform basic computer hygiene. Or, if you've been derelict in doing so, you add two-factor authentication. There's all kinds of fun things you can do.
You got to update, make sure you have the updated
software
on your computer.
By the way, why does mine always say to me, well, we're going to update you overnight, and then often on the iOS systems, and then they never do?
Maybe you have it set for delayed so it doesn't do it when you're on.
Okay. Let me check that.
It sometimes will slow you down, so...
But you can, of course, go into one of these private networks. What are they called, John?
VPN. VPN.
Yeah. Okay, you can go into. You can get behind a sturdier firewall.
You know, that's funny about the VPNs is the bad guys are using them to mask themselves.
Oh, there we go. Well, we're about to talk about that. Or you can ask your computer genius friend to hack into your system just to see what happens. You know, if you got somebody who really... 400-pound guy on the couch.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, that guy.
He's usually good.
He's very busy, but I think he's got his own show on TLC. By the way, if you haven't done this, try password protecting your Wi-Fi. Or walk up and down the street and figure out who hasn't done it.
Absolutely. That's not only password protected, but you can also hide your... there's ways you can hide... your transmit signal, so they it makes it a little tougher for you, but so people can't see that your system that you're
is
on.
They can't see anything about you.
Yes,
or you can try to break into the Russian military security apparatus
just for
kicks. Yeah. Hey, because they've done it to us. By the way, just coming in today to record with you, I really heard an interesting report that the Iranians. Now, again, we're going to hear in a later report how we are able to sanction all kinds of governments because all kinds of money goes through the United States because we're the reserve currency. Well, to get back at us, evidently, the Iranians now are hacking into a lot of political sites, and Microsoft is trying to help them out with, I think, over 2,000 political sites that they've hacked into.
And, you know, it doesn't surprise me, and it doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, you look at people who should be protecting our information, the Experian, you know, I mean, these are people
got hacked into.
But these are people that they're paid to protect our information.
Well, I know. And look, we've talked about in the Fifth Domain, offense versus defense. Go back and listen to that podcast. But you've got to listen to the one that we have now that we're just about to unveil in a special edition. Because it's a really important one about what's going on with towns and cities across the United States. And look, we all live in a town or a city that collects a lot of information about us, John. What do they know about us? They know the kinds of taxes we pay. They know whether we own our house and the title to our home. They have our birth records, or somebody does in some town somewhere. Right. They've got our school records. Oh, by the way, Queens, New York, if you're listening, we want Donald Trump's high school grades. Well, what's fair for the goose is fair for the gander. And by the way, if you come upon his tax returns, send those along too, okay?
So I'm a little surprised that that hasn't really shown up.
That's utterly amazing. But, it really is. But, well, that's another story for another time. But look, there's all kinds of important stuff that is on the servers of those who control state and local governments. And I know that the state of Connecticut, where we live, I remember a number of about 1 million attacks. I don't know if that was in the course of a month or a couple of months on the state system.
Well, I would bet that that's probably a month, I would bet.
About a million attacks.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Because if our website gets a few hundred, I can imagine that something like
John,
that.
John, did you just say that?
Something like that must get millions.
Yeah, and by the way, everything on our website, because we don't take any money from you, everything on our website is there for you. In fact, we want it out. We want it communicated. And we want people in Iran and Russia to listen to us. So take it. Take all of our episodes, over 300 of them. So anyway, well,
they're all downloadable.
But you think, thank you. But think about this, John. No, seriously. It's not only those administrative issues that we're talking about, but there are life and death issues like police, fire, emergency services. It's all there.
It's all networked now. Yeah, you're right. Everything, your dispatch centers now are all networked through computers so that they can get the 911, you know, calls faster. So it's all networked now.
Well, we are going to be talking about this with Dr. Frederick Scholl from Quinnipiac University, and they're running, John, a cyber crime master's program. And, of course, that's really interesting. And we know that we're training a lot of people to be able to defend against these attacks. We'll talk about whether we're growing them quickly enough and whether the information that they come out of these programs with is really relevant by the time they get to put it into use. But the big issue that we're talking about with Dr. Scholl, not to be confused with the other Dr. Scholl. No, I started reading his book, but there were way too many footnotes. No, but this Dr. Scholl, what we're talking about is ransomware.
Yes.
And I've been reading account after account of large cities, smaller cities, towns, boards of education. We had one right outside of this city.
Yeah, being held hostage by these. And who knows, you know, you sort of wonder if they get paid, do they actually let it loose anyhow? I mean, it's a real problem for cities and towns and everybody, really.
Not only that, but they're all insured at this point. But these insurance companies are saying, now, wait a minute. We're on the hook here. Why aren't you cleaning up your act so that we're not obligated? Because many times these expert hackers, these bad guy hackers, they know that they are insured. And there's a really interesting case that we talk about in New Bedford, Massachusetts, where they slowed the process down and perhaps gave us a blueprint as to how to handle these ransomware attacks going on all across America. It's a trend that no one else is talking about, I'm sure, on other podcasts, but we are. And we'll do it today with Dr. Frederick Scholl here on America Trends.
With me on the line is Dr. Frederick Scholl, and he is the Cybersecurity Program Director and a professor of cybersecurity at Quinnipiac University in Connecticut. There have been a spate of ransomware attacks across the country focused on government agencies, primarily at the local level in cities large and small. Dr. Scholl, is this happening because government agencies are more susceptible to attack, or because there's a sense that they aren't keeping up with security because they have money to pay and don't want to disrupt services in their community? Why is it that it seems so many of these governmental agencies, particularly on the local level, are being successfully attacked?
The bad guys out there are pretty well organized these days. You know, this has been established in different studies from law enforcement and things like this. So it's not just a couple of people sitting there figuring out, well, who should we target? Fortunately, they've organized their activities and they've put thought into where are the weak links. And I think, as you point out, government, especially small municipalities, have become targets. And I think there's a bunch of reasons for that. The people, the sort of criminal gangs out there looking at this and they're saying, how do we make money on this? So first of all, they have to find organizations that don't have the world's greatest security. So that does include government, unfortunately, especially small municipalities or smaller cities, for example. They just don't have the funds to come up with the latest security. So that's that part of it. And then The second thing that I see that's happening is that there's the role of cyber insurance. You know, these same government agencies don't have a lot of money to pay the ransoms that, you know, these people are trying to extort. But there seems to have been a group of insurance companies have stepped in, and this has happened in, you know, cyber insurance has come in a number of different arenas for breach protection, ransomware protection, and so there are kind of, quote, deep pockets out there that can pay some of these ransoms, right? If that wasn't there, then these organizations wouldn't be attacked. And I think another one is that government is providing, you know, critical services, whether it's running school districts, whether it's running fire, 911 systems, whatever. So there's a sense of urgency that these things have to be fixed. So it's kind of it's a type of denial of service attack that's based on extortion. And so I guess you've got weaker security, you've got ability to pay, you've got a sense of urgency. So I think it's a combination of all of the, and, you know, and then of course you've got the secure or relatively secure Bitcoin payment channel where these guys can actually get paid. So you've got sort of a perfect
storm.
Yeah,
it's quite an elixir going together for what's going on. Let's back up for 1 second, Dr. Scholl. What is ransomware for those who are new to the term?
You could call it a type of malware. So malware has been around for a long time. Originally, there were viruses that would hit your computer and pop up annoying message on your screen or whatever. And so ransomware is it's a small application that is going to, if your computer gets infected with it, it's going to encrypt your files on your computer to make them unreadable. And it does this using a key, an encryption key. And the way it works is the bad guys or the hackers are the only ones that have the secret key to make those files readable again. So they keep those, they send you a ransom message, they send you an address of a Bitcoin wallet. If you pay them, pay money, whatever it is, hundreds or thousands of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars into that Bitcoin wallet, they send you the decryption key, then you can see your files again. So that's the big picture of how it works. And the key things that people need to be aware of are how you get infected with this stuff. So one way is through phishing attacks, and the other one is through so-called watering hole attacks. So you have to kind of take steps against those to stay away, to avoid ransomware.
And what is the, I've heard of the phishing attacks, of course. Mm-hmm. I think we've all been struck by those. What's the water hole attack?
That is an even more insidious kind of attack, because with the phishing attacks, you need to train your users and you need to point out, you know, what do these email messages look like. The watering hole attack is one. Another way you can get infected is simply by going to a website. You don't have to even do anything. You just browse to a website. And normally you'd think that was okay, right? You're going to, you know, whatever website you're going to, eBay or Amazon or something like that. And those are pretty reliable websites, okay? But there are other smaller or medium-sized websites that also may not have the latest and greatest information security. So those sites can get infected with malware, and it could be ransomware-type malware. So by going to the site, you could inadvertently be downloading an actual ransomware-type malware. So you have to be really careful. What sites do you go to, you know, number one? And number two, you have to, you know, be very careful about ads that you click on and things like this. So it's the user has to be aware of what's going on and kind of use caution before clicking on anything.
Now, earlier this year, the authors of one ransomware strain announced that they were retiring because they had already earned $2 billion. And they said, "We have proved that by doing evil deeds, retribution does not come." How successful, or should I say, how much damage have these bad hackers done? Do we even know?
I don't think we know. I don't know, you know, the exact numbers, and they are somewhat speculative. Not everybody's, you know, there's no central organization that's keeping track of how much money is being paid out and that kind of thing. But I've been really impressed with the work that law enforcement's done, you know, FBI and people. Even though these guys may say, you know, there's no retribution, they're out there. Sometimes over periods of years, 1 to several years, I do see these people being tracked down, because don't forget, they're leaving some kind of digital footprint. And So I've been really impressed with the ability of law enforcement to go out and find these people. One of the challenges is if they're in other countries that don't have extradition agreements, then they're just going to stay there. But even then, you see these people traveling or going on vacations, and they get picked up then. So law enforcement's done an amazing job in this area. But I don't think we know the exact amount of money. And I'll just bring up one other thing, too. I just saw this. I was kind of surfing the internet to prepare for this conversation, and I saw another one. Symantec is now the big security company, is seeing a huge increase in a slightly different kind of attack. They're calling it a sextortion attack. So what people are being extorted for money to avoid having some type of personal recording or video or something like that posted on the internet. So it's kind of, you know, this stuff's been going on for years, but it's the scale is getting bigger and bigger through, you know, the gangs and botnets and more automation on the part of the bad guys.
Absolutely. It seems like the internet crime of the era. Some might say, those of us who aren't as expert in this as you, why pay for its retrieval from an evil hacker when you can likely just hire a good hacker to unencrypt and to figure out the, you know, machinations that have gone on?
Yeah, I think if the hackers, you know, and there's all different gangs that are out there, right? You mentioned the ones that were retiring. So there are different skill levels. But if the hackers are really good and they encrypt this data, there's the possibility that you're not going to be able to get it back. You know, you're not going to be able to reverse the encryption. If they're using state-of-the-art encryption protocols and they're, you know, doing them, setting them up in the right way in their malware, then that's not going to be reversible. And the other thing that comes up in this area is that, the you know, everybody has been taught for years you should back up your data, right? You just don't keep your data on one server or one computer. You have to back it up. You back it up in the cloud. You back it up in your data center. And so people have been taught this for years. And one of the challenges is that as the malware writers, you know, the people creating the ransomware, get smarter, they're able to not only encrypt, you know, the first copy of the data, but they're going to go out and look for backup copies and encrypt that too. So it depends on, you know, if you're the guy you were talking about, bring in an expert. If you've brought him in, see, what you need to do is bring him in ahead of time, not after you've been attacked. But if you bring in somebody like that ahead of time, who sets up your backup routines and where you're storing your data, then somebody like that would be able to restore the data, and you would just, you know, thumb your nose at the attacker and say, "We got the data here, and thank you very much, goodbye," you know, that kind of thing. But if you didn't do that, it's possible that you could have your primary data and your backup data both encrypted. And then if it's done right, it's going to be pretty much impossible to reverse that.
Dr. Frederick Scholl is with us, PhD, Cybersecurity Program Director, and Professor of Cybersecurity at Quinnipiac University. It seems as if in this battle, and this is a battle that's going on as it relates to cyber just about everywhere, it's offense versus defense. And it's good versus evil, if we want to put it that way. And it would seem as if the offense, those who want to get in, are a little bit ahead of the game, or is that true? And is defense catching up?
You're right about that, that the offense, the bad guys, are a little bit ahead. And this is true for very large corporations, large banks. And it's even more true for medium-sized organizations and definitely smaller organizations. And the reason, and so in our program at Quinnipiac, we're focused on defense, right? We teach the latest techniques for defending, you know, your assets against ransomware and any other type of breach. And the challenge that everybody's facing is that technology keeps changing. You know, now people are going to 5G mobile. More and more stuff is being done. You know, more computing tasks are being done in this little handheld thing we used to call a phone. So as long as this technology keeps changing, it gives opportunities for the bad guys to take advantage of it. You know, if we ever get to the point where technology isn't changing, then we're going to get ahead. The security guys are going to get ahead. But it's going to continue to be this foot race for the foreseeable future because, you know, the technology itself is changing. You've got, you know, all the things you know about the, you know, autonomous driving vehicles and stuff like that just bring up new avenues for hackers to attack us.
I don't even want to think about what you just said about self-driving cars.
Yeah,
but let's look
yeah.
at businesses and government. Mm-hmm. I mean, they yeah. are collecting all kinds of information yeah. about us. Customer engagement mm-hmm. in order to yeah. get a competitive advantage is yeah. really key, thus making mm-hmm. the information that much more valuable and indispensable yeah. to running yeah. their operations. If that's yeah. so, what is security of that data worth, and why is it in certain cases an afterthought?
This is a big issue. So not just the ransomware, but the enormous amounts of data that are being kept. You know, you've got credit card data, you've got other types of social security data, financial data, and now the latest is even more healthcare data is being moved into the cloud and will be available to, you know, consumers. And so there's going to be the benefit's going to be this, it'll be easier to share data with different healthcare providers, you know, if you go from one to the other. So that's great. The bad news is that data is going to be out there in the cloud. And you read about that Capital One breach associated with AWS or Amazon. So these things are, there are going to be more of these things happening. And I, you know, business is focused on profits. I think government has to step in more, and this is my personal opinion, and be more aggressive about regulating data privacy in particular and information security as well. So this has happened in Europe with the so-called GDPR legislation around privacy, and it's continuing to evolve there, right? It's not like a magic bullet that solves all the problems at once, but it's putting them, the European Union, going down a path that I think will offer more, you know, better data security as it gets improved and built on year over year. And I think we need to go down that kind of a path too, or start down that path, because these problems, you know, as you were saying, are going to get worse. And we don't really know. There have been hundreds of millions of records, all kinds of personally identifiable information breached in the last few years. We don't know who has it, where it's going, but it's not. You know, it's not, it doesn't have likely a great outcome.
Will basic internet security hygiene stave off these kinds of attacks? Some say, well, you've got to train your staff to recognize mm-hmm. suspicious emails, and we talked about that earlier. You have mm-hmm. to apply software patches, change default passwords, yeah. use two-factor authentication. I mean, are mm-hmm. any of those really the key to all of this, or all of them and more?
Yes, all of them. So security is talked about as like a holistic thing, right? It's as weak as the weakest link in the chain, that kind of thing. And so you did mention, you mentioned the human side, which comes, you know, which is critical, the training of people. You also mentioned the, you know, the technical side, the technology, the application. So all these things have to be addressed. You know, there's a very sort of forward-thinking government agency called NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, outside of D.C. They've written a lot of the they, you know, authored and sort of been a leader in what's happened on government security. And last year they came out with a very interesting kind of document saying, you know, security is everyone's responsibility. And so it's more, I think this mindset has to be established in companies and in individual citizens. You know, there's no tech company out there or no technology that's going to solve this problem, right? You look at these antivirus tools. People think, oh, I've got an antivirus tool on my computer, I don't have to worry about malware. But those are only, you know, somewhat, maybe they're 90-95% effective, right? So if you're being bombarded every day, there's another 5% there. The other thing is, this is kind of a timely podcast because next month is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. So Department of Homeland Security promotes events and, you know, information and webinars and things like that online. So it's a good month to kind of set aside some time and learn one new security defensive technique that, you know, you can use during the rest of the year. So it's all just, it's all about incremental improvement and providing incentives.
What role does insurance play in all of this? You talked about it earlier. Mm-hmm. The insurance companies, they often pay out on these ransomware attacks.
Yeah.
Are they taking notice and requiring that a company, to get the insurance, like we all have to do various things, demonstrate that our roof doesn't leak or that our heater is not going to need to be replaced in the next year?
Yeah.
Do companies and governments have to prove anything more, given the spate of attacks and the payouts that insurers are seeing themselves responsible for?
Interesting. This is kind of a changing field that's been evolving over the last 10 or 15 years. So what the first thing that happened is companies would write the they'd underwrite the policies. They had a fairly straight, they would send you a questionnaire about how secure are you. You fill out the questionnaire, and then you get the, you know, you'd get the insurance. So I think, you know, the benefits are that the company, if it's hit, you know, has some recourse to transfer the risk to the insurance company. So I think it's still an evolving area. We don't know. I don't think the companies know exactly what premiums they should charge. What are the payouts going to be? So it's somewhat of an, and, you know, what requirements. In theory, they could be, the insurance companies could be setting very high bars for companies to get this insurance, right? But then, you know, that's an economic issue for them if they're not writing insurance. So it's sort of an evolving area, and hopefully we'll come to the right balance where the bar is high and, you know, the payouts are managed and the policy premiums are managed, and we come to equilibrium where, you know, security is better than it is now.
Dr. Scholl, a lot of people will refer to a case in New Bedford, Massachusetts, where it seems they followed best practices in limiting the impact of an attack on them. The mayor there was reluctant to negotiate with the attacker, but decided to offer an insurance-covered payment. I think it was $400,000, not just in case the city could get the decryption key, but also to buy time. Now, I'm reading that the attacker rejected the offer, and the city opted to work toward restoring the systems with the help of constituents and consultants rather than to accede to the demand. At the same time, it seems as if they bolstered systems against a follow-up attack. Is this a good way to perhaps level the playing field?
It sounds good. I'm not familiar with the details of that, of how long it took them to restore it, and, you know, what was the cost? Did they have to go back to paper records, or maybe they had some backups for some of the information. So I think what you're talking about is kind of an incident response plan. So you're not going to have a perfect, there's not going to be the perfect world where you get hit with ransomware, you push a button and you're back online again. But so organizations should, and maybe these guys did a good job of it in New Bedford, it sounds like it, you know, go through, here's the attack scenario. You do the tabletop exercise. Here's where our data is. If we get hit with ransomware and this is encrypted, where are we going to get, you know, where is the backup data going to reside? How do we get, what's the recover time? So if an organization, and people have been doing incident response plans and exercises for a long time, right? It's a standard practice in information security. So I think what this is suggesting is that companies need to look, or organizations or municipalities or schools need to look at this specific type of threat and then develop an incident response plan for that one. Because it's never going to be perfect, right? It's never going to be a hit the button and we're back. The other alternative is fine. We just send them the $50,000 in Bitcoin. And, you know, it's still never going to be fine, right? Because you don't know for sure when and if they're going to send you the other key. So,
well, not only that, but I'm also reading that what they might send you back
isn't necessarily good, because it might not unlock corrupted data, which is often what results from their playing around in your system. So you may not be getting everything back.
Yeah, your system files, your applications, just because you have the data back, that doesn't mean you can do anything with it. So, yeah, you have to look at, you know, you've got an intruder in your network, and they're not that worried about whether your systems
function.
Like, if you lose data, your system may not function. You may get the data back, and that may not be good enough.
How important is it, thinking about this, for towns and cities, for example, to wall off and really double gate, triple gate emergency services, thinking about it, fire and police, so that any attack can at least be limited to administration, finance, basic services? I mean, if people can't pay their taxes for another 3 weeks, I don't think they'll mind. But fire and policing would seem to need special protections.
Exactly. So that's another good point you bring up, right? So organizations like municipalities or other businesses that are targets for this should be, so that's one of the sort of major defensive techniques, is to put internal, let's say, information bulkheads inside the whole organization, so that if somebody gets access to one set of servers for a certain type of data, they can't then just do a lateral jump over to another one. So this is the standard technique that hackers use. They get access to one server, they encrypt that one, then they jump over to another one through some type of weakness in a firewall or bulkhead protection. So organizations need to sort of upgrade the simple one-size-fits-all, or everybody can get access to everything type of data organization inside the municipality, and really firewall off the internal. It's called segmentation, network segmentation is kind of the technical term for this, but that's another extremely important defense. You may lose one type of data or one server, but you're not going to lose the whole organization.
Some are worried about attacks on the 2020 presidential election, making it impossible for some people to vote or their votes not to be registered. And then, of course, we have all these cities that are developing incredible capabilities so that they can provide services efficiently. They're called smart cities, but they're only smart, I guess, if they can hold on to their data, because they're using it more so than many others who might still use a combination of paper and computers.
Yeah, so you're bringing up, you know, what we're just talking about, the rapid evolution and revolution of technology, which, you know, is going to affect, we don't know how the 2020 election is going to be affected. It's going to be affected by information technology and data integrity one way or another. We don't know exactly how. And the same thing for the smart cities. So the security approach that has been talked about, you know, for the last 5 years is build security, and it's supposed to be as critical as what the, you know, the goals of what that the system's providing at the beginning. And if it, you know, in the past 20 years, including when the internet started, we didn't do that. We just threw it out there, added security in later. So it's kind of inexcusable if anybody's building some kind of smart city infrastructure or without building security in at the beginning. So hopefully that's what will be happening.
Just a couple of more questions. It's a fascinating area. What about the role of Bitcoin? You've pointed to this, and some say without Bitcoin, these payments, if they are necessary and there is no other resort, that this is what makes it all possible. Is that true?
I think, you know, this kind of cryptocurrency, it might be Bitcoin, it might be another one, but it seems to be one of the enabling technologies that's you know, enabled ransomware to really grow beyond just sort of a small cottage industry to be affecting a lot more people. So, yeah, it's one of the downsides of this new technology.
And how can you even be sure that you're paying the right person?
I guess you can't, right? You don't know who the right person is. You just have some kind of a numerical designation, pay this Bitcoin wallet you're kind of taking a chance at that point. So that's why organizations need to get their incident response plan up and running and do the tabletop exercise, because you're kind of in a real bind if you get hit with this.
Is there any consensus that we're talking about state actors here in this ransomware field, or individual actors, or gangs, or what are we looking at here?
Don't have any inside information on this, but you read reputable news articles. There are countries like North Korea gets mentioned as the source of a lot of these attacks. So the hackers have definitely organized into gangs. They cover different parts of the money laundering process. They cover writing the actual malware itself. They cover, you know, other groups are involved with packaging it into the right kind of attack system to, you know, we talked about the phishing. You got to package it into a phishing email, or you package it into a drive-by download on a website. So there's all these groups out there, and I don't think they're self-organizing. I do think that state actors are involved in funding these. They may not be, you know, like North Korea gets mentioned a lot. They may not be directly having people in the state doing this, but I think they're funding it. And it's apparently they may not be doing the $10,000 to $50,000 attacks on local municipalities, but there are bigger attacks on banks and larger cities that they may well be involved with. So I guess we don't really know, or I don't really know how these groups are organized. I think there's just like on the, you know, you've got your large municipalities, you've got your large enterprises, you've got your small businesses, you've got your medium businesses. I have a feeling the hacker group and the, you know, the deep web is organized in similar types of sizes of organizations.
In closing, at Quinnipiac University, you're training these white hat hackers, and you're trying to develop them quickly enough to deal with some of the issues that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. How is that going across the country in terms of cybersecurity? I know there are so many more programs developing. And how are you ensured that 15 minutes after they graduate, the techniques that they've learned are applicable to the changing technology? Or are you training them more to think about the whole process, recognizing how quickly it's all changing?
In terms of the industry, we need to do a better job. There's over 500,000 open positions in cybersecurity now. If you just go to a job board and search cybersecurity or information security, that's what you're going to see. They cover a wide range of disciplines. There's not like a one size fits all. That's one of the challenges. And so what we're trying to do, and other people are too, is to take people who have information technology experience, have business experience, and retrain them and move them into information security roles, as opposed to just taking people out of the technical disciplines like math, science, computer science. There just aren't enough of those people to fill all these positions. So we want to retrain people and enable them to go into that field. And so our program is definitely up to date when they graduate. So our first cohort is actually graduating this spring, this coming spring. And so you're right, we need to provide sort of continuing education. We have some programs that we have planned there for whether they're going to webinars or on campus seminars. We and others definitely need to provide effective kind of lifetime learning, or they're going to be a little bit obsolete. They're going to be 15 minutes obsolete, 15 minutes after they graduate, unfortunately. But we're aware of that, and so we're planning to start that as soon as they graduate in May.
Well, congratulations. Best of luck with that. Dr. Frederick Scholl from Quinnipiac University, cybersecurity. We thank you so much for being with us today. It's a fascinating, though very devastating topic to so many communities, businesses around the country, and we'll keep our eye on it. And now at least we have a lot better handle on it, having heard from you today.
Thanks very much, Larry. It was fun talking with you.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.